Hello, friends and folks, and welcome back to another episode of Refresh Rate, Scanline Media's check-in on the media we've been enjoying lately. I'm Six Detmar.
I'm Sheriff Runkle.
I'm Kyrie Page.
It's been a while. Was our last episode? I'm gonna guess our last episode was November.
Something like that. Yeah. So.
Let's see. I'm gonna type refresh and hit enter and. November 21st.
Damn. Got it in one.
Damn. So, 4 months, because we've been very busy.
We have. Since those 4 months, it was... Well, December is always a busy time of year, just in general. And then we did our gimmick awards, and that took up a lot of time as well, but... Turns out we found some time for things other than stuff we're already talking about.
Well, I don't know if I can say that in good conscience with my topic at hand here. But, you know, you're volunteering to bring some new material to us, Kyrie. I understand you've been playing the latest and greatest from Vanillaware, Unicorn Overlord.
That's right. This is, like I said, the latest game from Vanillaware. Vanillaware, for those who don't know, is a company that has a very specific art style. They tend to hand paint basically everything in their games. Or at the very least, everything has the appearance of being hand painted. So these are the people that made 13 Sentinels, Odin Sphere, Muramasa the Demon Blade, Dragon's Crown. Yep. And it's always interesting because you can't really pin down Vanillaware to one specific genre. You can kind of say they do a lot of fantasy stuff, but it's always a different flavor of fantasy just about every single time. And Unicorn Overlord is a game that is, you know, in the style of medieval fantasy, you know, akin to Final Fantasy Tactics, Ogre Battle, you know, Fire Emblem, things like that.
More of a European kind of medieval fantasy.
European medieval fantasy. It's a story about an evil empire taking over this continent and the one true prince, you know, that sort of shit.
Everybody loves a good king.
He doesn't have a holy sword in this particular instance. He has a ring. So the story conceit is this queen of this country called, I think it's Corneria.
Fifth planet of the Lilac system?
That's right.
Cornea.
This queen of Cornea, she gets betrayed and... with her most loyal knight, she sends her son out into the world, basically to protect him from this evil empire. And it's years later, and he's, you know, leading a resistance to it. Some very, very standard stuff, to be clear. But the way in which it presents itself is just so... confident that even though it's a story I am familiar with, they present it not in a new way, but in a way that is just captivating.
How so?
So I think it comes down a lot to, I think its prose is actually quite good. It really leans into the medieval fantasy of its own setting, of how it is set up. And I think that the characters are fairly simple. But I think it has to do with... It's hard to pin down because on its face, many of the contingent elements are just very standard fantasy fare. For example, there's a system in this game that is basically after certain battles, you have the ability to either spare the guy you're fighting or killing them right then and there, right? And it's very simple, to be clear. Most of the time it's just, okay, they tell some sort of sob story, so they make it not super complicated. It's just sort of, do you want to recruit this guy or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point in the story, there was actually a choice it gave me that gave me pause, which that surprised me. Because most of the choices are either the guy's a complete dirtbag, fuck this guy, or it's, you know, there are other circumstances or something, and also I want another thief in my party at some point, so sure, I'll let this slide. But at a certain point, when you go to the northern end of the first area of the game, you meet this woman who is part of this noble house who is protecting what little land she still has left that has been stripped from her and her people just in general, right? And You get a choice, like, after you beat her, because she's like, I gotta stand up against you at some point. Like, I just, it's the only way I can see, you know, it's the only way I can see this land surviving, right? And you beat her, and eventually, you know, you have one of your knight characters, Clive, talk with her, and she, like, changes her perspective on certain things, and she offers to, like, okay, I'll join your liberation army. And I went with the choice of saying, no, you really should probably stay home and protect these people.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. Even though it was a simple choice of, like, do I recruit or do I not? I wasn't even really thinking about the reward aspect. I was actually trying to do a little role-playing in this role-playing game. And I felt that it was more appropriate of a choice to have her stay where she is so that she could defend that portion of the land so that, you know, when Prince Elaine eventually, you know, emerges victorious, that's usually how these stories go, you know, there's something established, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact was, like, I could think about this choice and I could have gone either way on the choice. And I wasn't thinking just purely mechanics. It was actually a choice that got me to think about it for a little bit.
On the other hand, I mean, like, I haven't played very much myself, right? I've played like an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But the narrative conceit of this game is that the guy who overthrew your mother and now rules the kingdom is brainwashing everyone with brainwashing magic. And a lot of the time, you know, not all the time, and it sounds like talking to you, like, it's going to be less and less of a problem, but plenty of recruitment choices are like, hey, I was brainwashed. And your options are to say yes or no, which is kind of nothing.
Right. Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Like, brainwashing as a narrative conceit is such a, it's an easy out for the characters, but there are moral choices that you run into that are slightly more complicated than that.
I also want to mention that it's a bit more complicated than brainwashing, and how you react to it depends on whether you think it is stupid in a good way or stupid in a bad way, what the real situation is.
Right. For context, I'm about 12 hours deep. Closer to 11 hours into this game. And I think the thing that's really pulling me through is I just really like its gameplay a lot. Mm-hmm. I think I really love how, in the way the game is set up, is you have your units and you set them in basically blocks. and they attack automatically when you send them into battle. And eventually you unlock the ability to modify their tactics. And the granularity of the tactics you can apply is not so granular that it becomes overwhelming, but granular enough that you feel like you're actively making choices about how this game's combat works. Because it's more than just, you know, guy has bigger number, they win. There is a lot of variance to unit typing. There's no, you know, weakness triangle or anything like that. But certain classes just naturally do better against other classes. And I really like how I've basically set up different units that have different roles in the battlefield. Like Elaine's best friend, Lex, his unit are kind of, I've, in my head, you know, a lot of this is role-playing in my head, certainly. They are like gate breakers because I have like this one unit who has a massive hammer with them and he moves fast. So I use it to break down barricades and things like that.
It's kind of like your units are, like, the way you can customize them and build them out, it's like you're forming different, like, JRPG parties as individual units.
Absolutely. And I brought up Fire Emblem earlier because one of the points of comparison is as units fight together, they have relationship conversations that you can view, and they will grow as they fight together. But one thing I appreciate is they introduce a system where in certain towns they have taverns and you could just pair up like groups of four or five units and have them share a meal together, and that will deepen their bonds. So you don't have to necessarily grind out battles in order to raise relationships with other characters. What else?
I think a lot of like what it's coming down to is this, like, the game feels like really, really like elegant executions of pretty, like, not necessarily simple ideas, but playing a lot to just like genre stereotypes in a way that, like, I mean, one of the things, like, the sort of controversies around this game is around the localization, right? Because this is sort of people, by and large, gamers are still attached to the idea of translation, not localization, which is stupid, right? They're stuck in the past. And not even in the past, because in the past it was like necessary because you literally didn't have enough space in the text box to be literal. But the dynamics of writing in, for example, America versus Japan, a lot of fiction writing is around, like, the meta, if you will, is kind of around assembling tropes, right? It's sort of like combining them and having like senses, like you can have the same line of dialogue said like 20 times in the game because it's just a very generic line that people say under the situation. And that is how, whether or not you like it, that's a personal preference thing. That is how, like, a lot of fiction tends to be written in Japan right now and in anime and games and, you know, other visual media. In America, that's not how, what we tend to consider good writing. And so part of localizing is gussying up the language a bit, right?
Right. And here it feels appropriate because the presentation is so much of, you know, old medieval fantasy. And so I think it's a really appropriate and smart localization choice to make the prose a little purple, to make it about capturing the feeling of, like, it's not Shakespeare, right? But it is trying to emulate that way in which we conceptualize medieval fiction, and they do it more than just having characters say these and thous and things like that. It's the way in which they add flourishes to their sentences. Like, there's still one very early in the game that I really liked where, you know, it's the one that was like a point of, you know, minor controversy by very ignorant people about how this girl, Scarlet, says something, "As surely as the sun will rise, my friends will rescue me." And it's very evocative language throughout. I typically have a policy of I play Japanese games in Japanese, but I actually switched over to the English, and the English is quite good because the way in which the actors are delivering these lines also just adds this, there's certain something to it that I really liked. I really liked, try and remember the name of the character. He is a hoplite that you recruit fairly early on. Give me a second.
While you're looking, just wanted to mention that I do agree with Kyrie that the English dub is very good, and it adds this level of theatricality to the performance that I appreciate.
I'm playing in Japanese, and I'm not sure that I recommend. I mean, it's certainly well done, but part of what I enjoy is just a particular type of sicko that I am, right? Where it's really fun to me to see, you know, lines like, you know, like, I'll claw at you from hell itself, and the Japanese line is like, no. It's just like, the contrast is really fun.
The contrast is fun. Okay, I figured out. It's Hodrick, and he is voiced by Evan Michael Lee, who is the English voice actor for Negori Yuki in Guilty Gear Strive, and he is just, he is stellar. Like, just as a performer, that he, like, I really find that, like Jen said, it really elevates the material in a lot of ways. And I think it's one of those things that would be carried by the way the script is written in Japanese as well, but it's through differences of word choice rather than the tone itself.
I think the vibe is different, but not the tone, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a lot of Vanillaware, I mean, like, I think if I think of, like, I think of basically four Vanillaware games. I think of 13 Sentinels, Dragon's Crown, I guess five. Anyway, the point is, I feel like there are kind of two styles of Vanillaware game to me. There's stuff like 13 Sentinels, there's stuff like Odin Sphere, where it is this, like, the world building is very elaborate and intricate, and it feels like a very imaginative and, like, different take on things, right?
It's Odin Sphere, especially, was, in my recollection, a game that is striving towards the way epics were written in the classical sense.
And Unicorn Overlord feels to me more like Dragon's Crown. In the way of, like, it is trying to tackle something pretty familiar and just give it a spin and, like, give it a tone and accent to it that just feels distinctly its own. It's like, no, we are doing a thing you know, but we are doing it our way.
Yeah. I can agree with that. And just in general, I think the game is excellent. I think it is absolutely more than the sum of its parts. It is, I don't know if narratively it'll take any wild swings, but I have gotten deep enough in the game in which I'm starting to see the hints at what Jen was inferring, because I think, Jen, you basically spoiled yourself a little bit on parts of the game. Is that right?
Yeah, I read this excellent co-host post by Harper J, who used to write for Kotaku and a bunch of other places, that basically went into how this is one of those games where you technically can do a Tears of the Kingdom or Breath of the Wild thing where you rush directly to the final confrontation if you think that you are strong enough to handle it. But if you do that, the game punishes you. Like, not just with difficulty, but also, like, that's the most guaranteed way for you to get the worst possible ending. And, yeah, I find that really fascinating, because, like, Harper gave this good argument about how it's essentially being like, okay, if you manage to do this, you're pretty good at the game, but that also makes you a pretty shit king, for all respects. So, if you take your time and actually do the thing, build up your alliances, and then go at it, then you've basically earned the correct ending.
I don't think I agree. Like, I've also done some reading. First of all, to get the best ending, you have to get married, which is a lot.
Oh. There is a lot. I am now suddenly reminded of there's a character that you can recruit in this game who is just sort of, who sees Elaine as just sort of like, oh, I want to be with him. And that's like her entire personality. And that's not super great.
Oof.
But I mean, like, I think part of the thing is, like, the thing with those different endings is, I don't have full context. I've only done some reading. And I do intend to play more of this game because I was having good time with it. I just have a lot on my plate right now. And I'm starting to finish some things. I know I say this all the time, but I am actually starting to finish some things.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, first of all, like, it is harder to rush to the ending, and so punishing people like okay, this was a harder way to play the game, therefore you get a bad ending. Like, I don't know that I need to gate the good ending behind a bunch of shit, but it feels very weird to say you can only get the good ending if you've made the game as easy as possible. And then the other thing is just, I don't agree, like, strategically, if it is a bad thing to clean up your own mess, I don't understand your politics. Right? Like, I agree that it is a good thing to form allegiances, but like, if you can, I mean, the other thing is, this guy is doing active damage every moment he's on the throne. Why is it a bad thing to nip that in the bud and then take care of the other problems? To, like, cut the snake's head off. Don't cut it off from the tail inch by inch, if you can. And so it was a well-written post, and I thought it was interesting, but ultimately I ended up pretty strongly disagreeing.
Mm. Fair enough. For me, that post made me think, okay, this is definitely a game I should sit down with and play at some point.
I think people should. I think people should check this game out. Yeah, there's a lot to get into just in general with it. I think that, yeah, it's just really fun. And it has been good for me to be able to play it between other things, because a session can be rather short. Doing a mission only takes a couple of minutes, and that's good for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a surprising of a game of this scale can give you such, like, bite-sized experiences while still not feeling like it is, like chopping things up such that it makes it feel small, you know? So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It makes it sound like it's kind of the perfect portable game, like, more or less built for the Switch, because having a longer narrative that you can just take in bits and chunks sounds perfect for a portable system.
And also, just, yeah, like, the way it cleanly divides things to do is good on that front. Anyway, I think it's really cool. I'm really excited to play at some point. I bought the special edition for myself, and one of the things that came with it is a card game that I haven't dived into yet, but it seems really neat. Like, I think mechanically it seems really interesting, because it's a deck builder style game that uses over 200 cards, and I feel like it is probably one of those things that during development they made a card game to test things out before working on full development, and then it was like, well, we have this card game already, Let's just make it a thing. I think that's like a cool, that's a legitimately really cool bonus to have for that sort of thing. Like normally I just don't go for special editions of things, but that made me very tempted.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of comes in a cruddy box though, but I'll fix that problem myself.
And it's kind of a shame how limited the release is, you know, because it means a lot of people will never get a chance to experience it.
Yeah.
Sadly, that's Sega for you.
What else has Sega done like that before?
Sonic the Hedgehog. Any other questions?
Sure. But not at this time.
Okay. All right. From one medieval setting to another, because Jen, you've been kind of normie, huh? You've been kind of mainstream.
Kind of normie-pilled.
I guess you could call it that, yeah, because I've been spending my time watching a show on FX/Hulu called Shogun. It is the most recent adaptation of a 1975 novel by James Clavell, which also received its own miniseries in 1980. And the thing about both of those is that, I guess I should just explain the base of the story first. You're basically following along in the 1500s this English maritime pilot named Pilot Major John Blackthorne, as he more or less travels over to Japan with the last of the five ships that set out for there. Because he's only on a single ship with like 12 people, because everyone else ended up dying, they get captured pretty easily. And as soon as he lands, he runs into a Portuguese priest who sees him and goes, "Oh shit, this is the pirate that's been blowing up a bunch of Portuguese settlements. We've got to make sure that the Japanese see him as a pirate and kill him." And essentially, he's more or less traded back and forth between different factions as this sort of token until he ends up getting the right message to the right people. And because of that, becomes something of an advisor to the fictional equivalent of Tokugawa Ieyasu. Since this is kind of a fictionalized retelling of what brought about the Tokugawa shogunate. Yeah, the thing about the 1975 novel and the 1980 miniseries is that, well, it is basically written from the perspective of Blackthorne as he comes there. And based on Clavell's writing of the 1980s miniseries, it is hella orientalist, and it mostly focuses on how cool this white guy is. And
I mean, it's The Last Samurai.
Kinda, yeah. It shares a lot of stuff with that. But over the past few years, a movement kind of got started within the producers at Hulu and FX, and they got Hiroyuki Sanada to produce and star as Toranaga. And the show effectively takes the story that was written from the perspective of Blackthorne and switches it over to Toranaga. And because of that and a few crucial other changes, it can't entirely clear what it was based on. It, just from a matter of fact, like, if your source is, as Six said, The Last Samurai type story, you can't exactly erase that entirely. But they basically turn Blackthorne into one piece eat a bunch of moving pieces. And it almost turns it into a Game of Thrones style story where there's a lot of politicking happening in the background. People saying, almost, what would you have me do? And just getting into some cool skullduggery. What'd you say?
And
Nothing. Go ahead.
And then just a lot of people watching a guy swing a sword and shouting, go white boy, go. Though I guess that is kind of funny because Hiroyuki Sanada was in The Last Samurai.
He was. You're right.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, the guy they got to play Blackthorn, Cosmo Jarvis, his performance is unfucking real because he has chosen a very specific...
You showed me a clip at one point that is the most buck wild thing with in terms of how this guy is performing. It is the most, like, to set the scene, basically, or Jen, you set the scene a little better because you've watched the show.
Okay, so Torunaga at this point is under house arrest, more or less, within the main city. And because of that, he's more or less just waiting for his death to happen because everyone else on the council he used to be part of in Osaka is like, yeah, we got to get this fucking guy. And one thing leads to another, and Blackthorn and some of the other people under Torunaga are being sent out in a way. There happens to be three carriages that are carrying women. At one point, Blackthorn catches Torunaga sneaking into one of the carriages, basically wearing the same, like, cloaked headdress as the others were wearing so that no one notices that he's swapped places. And they come across a checkpoint where a guard just starts looking through the various carriers. He just stands there for a moment being like, oh, no one else noticed this. No one else is going to stop him. This is bad. So he turns on full white boy mode, comes at this guy being like, this is unacceptable. Peering into ladies' quarters? I admire the purity of a woman! And just goes full on carpet. Goes full on scenery chewing until he gets punched around. And someone at the front gate is like, hey, what the fuck is going on back there? Y'all need to leave. Please stop doing this. And, a lot of other bits of his performance are more restrained than that, but generally, he chose this very specific old English accent that he goes full bore with. And there was a point where the producers actually asked him to choose a slightly different accent, because, his original accent for the project was even more buck wild.
and he said, no.
Well, he did have to tone it down, but yeah.
Listen, actors have only so much power.
Yeah, essentially the general plot of the situation, like the overarching situation within Japan at this moment is that... the Portuguese are spreading Catholicism through Japan and have been installing secret bases throughout the islands near Japan. And more or less between communications with one another have talked about Japan as this thing that they already own. So Blackthorn, being a Protestant instead of a Catholic, basically storms in and is like, look, they more or less see you as already owned. If you don't stop them, like, they already have converted people to Catholicism within your council. If you just let this go, they're just going to take your country and it's going to fucking suck. So after revealing this information to Torunaga, Blackthorn gets moved away to a safer place, is made Hatamoto and gets his own regiment and, bounces between doing things that are incredibly smart and incredibly, incredibly dumb. It's also a love story of sorts because Torunaga's main translator, Todo Miracle, ends up more or less initially being very apprehensive towards him because she learned English from the Portuguese Catholics. She sees herself as pretty devout. And here comes this stupid asshole who, when asked to bathe, just smells himself and is like, well, it's only been 5 days. Why should I bathe now? But yeah, over time, the two of them just get to talking and develop this nice friendship that develops into something more as it goes on.
Now, Jen, you were telling me a little before we got on that apparently the producers had multiple layers of translation or something that they were going through. Like, what was that all about?
Yeah, so they basically wanted to ensure that all the dialogue being said was legit. So instead of doing any sort of shortcuts, they had this 9-step process where their writer's room wrote down the script in English. A producer on the show would come to them and be like, no, they wouldn't say this back then, or they wouldn't do this back then. And after going back and forth a bit there and getting into a good situation, the script was sent to translators in Tokyo who translated it into modern Japanese. Then that script was handed to a playwright who specialized in shirageki and spoke no English, but he had the modern Japanese script. He made it more flowery, something closer to what that time would sound like, while also just adding a lot of theatrical embellishments. And by the time they needed to create English subtitles, instead of using the English script, they took the script touched up by the Jidaiki specialist and translated that back into English. So the result is pretty much everyone who has seen the show has commented on how the subtitles and the words being spoken are pretty much pitch perfect.
I don't know if it was worth all that effort, but that's cool.
Yeah. The point is, they are really going out of their way here to, like, they don't say it so much outside of interviews, but there's definitely people who are like, look, we know this book kind of sucks, even though it was super popular. We want to do justice to, we want to basically make a version that doesn't suck so much. And yeah, what they've come up with is really gripping to watch. Like, it's a very good story with a lot of different skullduggery, as mentioned before. And there's amazing moments like, essentially, there's this one guy, this very sniveling person who is more or less Torunaga's right-hand man, but also is trying to defect to the other side. And throughout the story, he's basically given an opportunity to talk to one or the other and be like, oh yeah, I'm totally loyal to this one person or this other person. And the defection never works for him. So this comes to a head where their location is visited by a messenger from Osaka who's like, okay, guy, we need you to come back and talk to the person in charge because things are getting kind of hairy. And he's like, well, I can't do that because I know you're going to cut my head off. But if you stay here for a day, we will show you the special canon techniques we have been perfecting. Torunaga's son does not like the idea of showing these people their military strategies. So overnight, he devises this plan where they all come to meet together. And he's just staring down the messengers who are basically giving him little insults like, oh, hey, what's it like playing ruler for your older dad? And after that happens, he basically takes his sword, does an upward motion, and some of the cannons, which were strategically relocated, shoot these massive cannonballs right at these men and their horses, and it's a fucking bloodbath in this amazing way. Like, horse parts go flying everywhere, a guy's face gets destroyed, and it's a lot of fun to watch.
This is the classic Jen just unsold me.
The first episode does have a moment where you watch someone get boiled alive. So it is pretty gruesome when it comes to it. But overall, it really is about the drama in between those really sick moments.
Mortal Kombat moments, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're having fun.
I didn't realize that the horse guts were an aspect of this. I just thought it's like, oh, this is going to be, you know, political wheeling and dealing style show. It's like, oh, wait, Jen said Game of Thrones. I should have known that.
So there are moments where people are invited to something and it turns out to be a trap.
Who knew?
Yeah, so far, 5 episodes in out of 10, and having a spectacular time, so I'm eager to see where it goes over the next few weeks.
Yeah, at least it's got a nice short and sweet runtime, at least for now. There, you know, we'll see what happens as far as maybe subsequent seasons or whatever. We'll see what they do.
The original was also, well, the original adaptation was also a 1980s miniseries, so basically both attempts so far have just been one and done situations. And also, like, this is the most expensive show FX has ever done, because they tried to film it in Japan, but as it turns out, there's not a lot of empty space left that they can film in and make it look coastal and stuff like that. So they ended up building several full-scale Japanese cities in Canada.
I love to be smart. This is the thing, is you hear the stuff about the making of these shows and you're like, yeah, no wonder it looks, I mean, that's an amazing thing to achieve. It's also a really stupid use of money.
I'm glad they went the extra mile though, because it's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, that's cool. Speaking of dead Japanese men, is this my transition?
Oh, oh no!
Speaking of works involving, I sent a clip that we'll have to check out later. It involves some like incredible choreography. Speaking of works with incredible choreography, Six, you've been checking something out on your own,
starring dead Japanese men.
Oh my god!
Yeah. No, like a couple of other things we've been working on recently. The passing of Akira Toriyama, the artist behind, you know, Dragon Quest and Dragon Ball and Chrono Trigger and a bunch of things, was a real bummer. That guy's work meant a lot to me, and he seemed like a really cool guy. And we've already talked about that on some other shows and things, but it was occasion for me to go back to a game I meant to give more time, which was Dragon Ball Z Kakarot.
This was the CyberConnect 2 action game, if I recall correctly.
Yes, this is the story game that is supposed to be just playing through the plot of Dragon Ball Z and then Dragon Ball Super, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Not complete Super, but there's some, you know, some of the storylines are represented. It is sort of a action RPG-y in its presentation. When it came out, I got it, I don't know, within like a month or two of launch, and I got stuck, right?
How'd you get stuck?
So, the Kaioken.
Classic technique.
We all know this technique. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It's, you're draining your own stamina in order to multiply your power. Goku, you know, it's his first big, you know, sort of transformation, air quotes on transformation, because really he just sort of his muscles got bigger for that one. But it's obviously how he was able to win the fight against Nappa and Vegeta to finish the Saiyan saga, the first big arc of Dragon Ball Z. Now, in a lot of games, well, not in a lot of games. Okay, the part of the reason this comparison came to me is because Kiria and I have another project that'll be coming out soon, involving Dragon Ball Xenoverse 2, mm-hmm. right? And for what happened there was, like, I played some Xenoverse 2 to sort of to do my research, and I was like, boy, there are some good and bad things about how this plays, huh? And I was like, I remember they did Kakarot, and Kakarot was just like Xenoverse 2, but like a full story game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not like this weird thing that Xenoverse is. And that's not true. That was my memory. That's not correct. Kakarot is a much better made game.
Yeah, it's Cyber Connect 2. Like, they tend to license stuff to fund their passion projects, but like when they're really in there, they're really in there.
And I think like part of the reason I had that impression is playing them like separate from each other. It's like clearly Bandai Namco, who makes all the, who has the license for making Dragon Ball fighting, any Dragon Ball video games, clearly has a vision for how these games should play. Where it is like this style of like lock on and like, you know, like super dashes and, you know, like the control schemes and the way that the combat is laid out is very similar between the two. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But playing them side by side, you get an appreciation for just how much more elegant and smartly executed Kakarot is as an experience. I don't think it would work very well, you know, multiplayer. Right. But
they're trying
as to, a single player game works pretty well.
Yeah, because from what I know of Dragon Ball Z Kakarot, is it's sort of in the style of like my touchstone is the Budokai Tenkaichi fighting games, in which classically it's behind the back camera, mm-hmm. and it is, you know, you're mostly seeing the back of Goku as he beats up Frieza or whoever. It sounds like they pull the camera back for this one because it's more about positioning or something like that. Like, tell us a little more about how this game plays.
There's a lot of speed and movement to it. You have, like, I mean, generally speaking, it's like open world, and then you get into fights, and at that point, it just sort of, I guess they're probably invisible walls. It doesn't really come up. There might not be. It might just sort of dephase all the other NPCs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels very much like a Dragon Ball fight. I will say, even from the start, the fights are taking place mostly in the sky, which, of course, in Dragon Ball Z, it takes a little bit to get there. In Kakarot, that's just how things are done. But it is like, you know, you both have, like... Like you're playing like Kingdom Hearts, you have like multiple HP bars that you're knocking down, and you have, you know, your ki, and you, some of your attacks use up your ki, and you can charge up and blah, blah, blah. Now, the Kaioken thing.
Okay, back to the Kaioken.
In Xenoverse, mm-hmm. You've got 3 meters. You've got health, ki, and stamina. When you turn on Kaioken, it starts draining your stamina. When you run out of stamina, you get stunned, right?
Mm-hmm.
So turn off Kaioken before you run out of stamina so you don't get stunned.
That's what King Kai told Goku.
Pretty much. In Kakarot, there is no stamina meter. So it just drains your health.
Oh, no.
So in order to do more damage, you are burning your health. And if you're in a hard boss fight where you keep getting killed, turning on your own health being burned away is kind of like, I don't know if this is helping, you guys. I can't tell if it's better to kill myself or have them kill me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was where I got stuck my first time playing Kakarot, is when they introduced the Kaioken, so not very far in, right?
Yeah, that's very early.
That's very early. They do, like, do a lot of fleshing things out, so there is more content than you'd think in there. You also don't exclusively play as Goku. You play as Piccolo, you play as Gohan. I know you'll get to play as Vegeta, and I think you'll get to play as Krillin, you know. But that's where I got stuck, and I was thinking about that game again, because I was like, I would have liked to see more of that game. And I talked to a friend recently, and they're like, oh yeah, that's a real bottleneck is the Kaioken. But then future transformations like Super Saiyan only use ki, and it's much less of a problem. And that's kind of just like you hit a difficulty wall and it gets way better after that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, I've been modding a games a lot recently. I wonder if someone has a mod that makes it so Kaioken doesn't drain your health. Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Someone has that mod. So I got that mod. And I played through. And so coming back to Kakarot, I have a couple of like thoughts. One is, I feel like in conversation with another game we're playing recently, that's a big blown out open world thing. The open world stuff feels really pointless and tedious and shouldn't be here. I can go fishing and I can gather fruit and cook, and you know me, I love cooking. This is all shouldn't be here.
You can also do that side quest where you do the driver's license episode or whatever.
I mean, sure, once you get to that point of the story, I can't do that till the Cell Saga.
Mm.
It's gonna be a while.
Yeah.
But one of the things they do that is kind of an interesting, like, it's interesting how these people doing a comprehensive retelling of Dragon Ball Z, and even adding some stuff that wasn't there before, adding some extra details and stuff, interact with the writing of Akira Toriyama.
What's up?
So you have the classic scene where Gohan is being trained by Piccolo and then sees the moon and transforms into a great ape for the first time, and the Piccolo blows up the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
That all happens exactly the same here. It's very well recreated. The animations are really great, which, by the way, the Xenoverse animations and cutscenes look like shit. People are like constantly, their animations are like, oh God, your bones. Oh God, your bones. Not the case in Kakarot. Looks great. However, after I finished that cutscene, I got like a Dragon Ball Z encyclopedia entry, and I pulled it up, and it says, of course, Piccolo didn't blow up the moon. He cast an illusion that the moon was gone, which is why later in the show, the moon is just back. You're like, guys, guys, it's okay. It's okay that Toriyama forgot he blew up the moon. Piccolo did, in fact, blow up the moon.
Twice. Well, Piccolo.
Twice.
Well, Piccolo did.
Three times if I could.
Yeah, it's fine. It's actually okay. No one cares that hard.
No one cares
except,
that hard.
Except the people who, like, document power levels, I guess.
Or it's like, oh, we have, you know, the Saiyan saga finished. Here's a little down arc, like a little, just a tiny little down segment where it's like Gohan, like, fetching a recipe from a neighbor for Chi-Chi, and then going to visit, you know, Kame House and being like, yes, I am fine, I did not die. It's like, I know that we sort of understand reading the manga, watching the anime, that probably something like that happened. We didn't actually need to see it, you guys. It's fine, it's not a problem, but you are being a little too thorough here.
is it Dragon Ball Z Kakarot that has, like, there was a screenshot going around recently on Twitter that was Yamcha saying like, huh, Bulma is really getting buddy-buddy with Vegeta, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
The quote tweet that was like, don't even worry about it, brother.
I mean, there are times where it's like funny, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes not. It's never like terrible, right? But like, I had another instance where I was like, there was an icon on my mini map, and there was a guy like just like hands on his hips, just like, you know, action posing next to a car. And he's like, hey man, you want to race? Oh shit, I'm sorry. You don't have a orange text driver's license. And I'm like, okay, I'll come back when I've got a driver's license.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's just like, that's a lot. It is very fun how theatric the fights get when you have like the big important fights. And again, I've only had a couple so far.
Mm-hmm.
I will say the Raditz fight, not that exciting, because Raditz is not that exciting. But fighting Nappa and fighting Vegeta, especially fighting Vegeta for the first time because I got stuck on Nappa because that's where I unlocked Kaioken. Really cool. You get to do some fun stuff with like beam struggles. I was, this is where I learned that my mod did not work. It was too many versions out of date. Kaioken was draining my health, but I think they nerfed the drain, or I just got better at the game. I think they nerfed it, though. I doubt I got better.
They've been updating this game for 4 years at this point, so I imagine they've done a few balance changes here and there.
Probably, yeah. I mean, like, there's a new DLC that came out this month. I mean, they're just going for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you get to do, like, beam struggles. You know, you're turning Kaioken on and off as, like, the fight flows different ways. They have a great, like, stun system and, like, you know, parries and counters and, you know, I guess not instant transmission, just very fast movement, right? Vanishes. And it's just, it was really cool. Like, there is a special, like, meter. I don't know what it's called, but there's sort of, like, I'm going to call it like an excitement meter or something. It sort of builds up as you do stuff over the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's full, you can temporarily go into a powered up state. And in that state, if you land a full combo and land the finisher on the end, you smash them through a series of mountains. And then you do a quick time event to teleport behind them and punch them into the ground.
Yeah.
It's like, that feels fucking great.
That sounds awesome. I love that shit. It's because that's like the classic thing from the show is someone being punched through a mountain and the combatant instant transmission or vanishes to be right behind them and slams them into the ground.
Mm-hmm. Or like I did, you know, like a beam struggle between, you know, like Gallic Gun and Kamehameha. That was fun. And that was like, that was dynamic. It was because I could have just like dodged out of the way and punched him in the back of the head, but I saw him winding up to Gallic Gun and I fired Kamehameha and then did a beam struggle. It's like, great. That's fun.
They should, when you come up with ideas like that or react in the right way, they should take a cue from the James Bond games and give you Goku moments.
No, they should just give you James Bond moments. You just fire the Kamehameha goes ba-da-da-da-da.
burner.
So yeah, I got through that, had a good time with that. There's also some fun little stuff, just like shout outs to, like, again, unlike Toriyama, them remembering things, right? Where, like, in the open world, after fighting Raditz, or no, before you fight Raditz, you can, like, talk to Master Roshi, and he's like, yeah, I don't know what's up with lunch. It's like, hey, you remember lunch exists, right? Or I had a random side quest to help out Pilaf and the Pilaf gang, because they made a killer robot and it was trying to kill them. And they're like, please help, we're probably bad guys, but it's okay, don't worry about that.
Don't worry about it.
It's just like... Or Aider. I hung out with... You remember Aider? You guys might not even know Aider.
Who is
Aider? Aider is the, like, Frankenstein's monster-looking android.
Yes.
From the Red Ribbon Army, who's a pacifist.
Okay, yes. I read a little bit more Dragon Ball after we recorded Oops All Manga on it, so...
Yeah. I think sometimes he's translated as, like, Ape-Man or something.
Yes.
But Aider, I believe, is the more common these days. And he was just like, yeah, there's some bad androids around here, but... You know, I don't like fighting. You seem to like fighting. If you were to deal with that, that'd be really cool of you. And you're like, no problem, bud. I got you. And I was like, you know, I did all this. I powered through. I'm about to start the Namek saga. About to leave for Planet Namek, right?
Do open world activities on Namek, I guess.
And then I had a weird moment, right? Because I was doing some of the quests in between, like sort of like the sort of that like Gohan, you know, going around getting some food and stuff, right? And I was like, hang on a minute. This feels kind of familiar. So I booted up my PS5 and I popped in my disc and I downloaded my cloud save and I was like, I did beat that fight. I actually stopped at the beginning of the Namek saga as I was about to fight the Ginyu Force for the first time. All of this was for nothing.
Oh, that's good.
But I'm having fun. It's nice to play it on PC. I will probably keep going. It's just very funny to realize that this was all based on a myth in my head of what a bad time I had, that probably I lost the fight twice, and then I beat it, and it was fine.
God. I've had that game in my library for a while now because I keep telling myself, okay, after I finish C, I'm going to get to it. But from the sound of things, I should also just finish reading Dragon Ball first and then get to it.
I mean, you can't. The Dragon Ball stuff isn't particularly important. It's just little side quest stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think this game is pretty fucking long. You could start it now, and you probably would. It would take you quite a while to catch up with where you left off in Z, unless you left off, like, you know, as Raditz was dying, which I suspect is not true.
We are in the middle of the Boo saga.
Hoo boy. That's a long saga.
Yes, it is.
Especially even on the Kai version, where they did not cut as much as they did from the other seasons.
There's DLC for like super stuff, as I mentioned, but also the last bit of DLC is the 23rd Tenkaichi Budokai fighting Oob.
Oh, yeah?
So that, I obviously am nowhere near being able to reach any of that, but that sounds pretty cool.
Hmm.
I know, doesn't it also, like, tap into some of the OVA stuff? Like, isn't there, like, a Bardock chapter?
There is a Bardock chapter that's DLC as well. That's, you can, like, some of them that are not, that are different characters, you can play separately. You can also do, like the history of Trunks, the future Trunks thing.
Ooh, okay.
And that's, again, like, you just pick that from the main menu and you can do that. Though I think there are some progress elements that you can then port into the main game. I don't know. I haven't done them yet. But, yeah. You can, you could play as Bardock. Everybody loves Bardock. I think everyone's feelings about Bardock, both positive and negative, are so much stronger because of Fighters now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Either people are like, damn, Bardock's fun, or if I see that level 3 one more time, I'm going to fucking kill somebody. You say, yeah, I'm going to kill somebody, and they say, you're the one who's going to die!
We saw, it was so funny, in the lead up to Super Broly, Jen and I went to a, they were doing a limited theater run of Legend of Bardock and Fusion Reborn, and mm-hmm. I remember watching that, and Bardock, it's a stupid OVA, but I still liked it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about most of those, is like, they're, a lot of them, almost all of them are pretty bad, but they're still fun.
Yeah. Fusion Reborn
and
is
that
just...
moment with the headband is just iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just cool.
But that's you know, that's what I got on Kakarot for now. I think, you know, we've all had our different divergences, the different things been keeping up our time recently, taking up our time, but we've also had something in common, folks.
Hey,
we've been like, oh god, they're purging emulation from the internet. We have to download everything now.
We gotta do this now. We gotta do it quick.
Turns out it wasn't nearly as bad as we thought it was, because like after they switched to that new format for a few days, they went back to their old format. But
it could be gone tomorrow, Jen. You never know.
You never know.
We could be saying it wasn't that bad, and tomorrow it'll be like, oh my god, there are kill squads out there hunting anyone who ever installed Nesticle. It could be over yesterday. Maybe we just didn't hear yet.
Yeah, I think a lot of people got really freaked out because of the Yuzu emulator going away at the same time mm-hmm. as Citra, because Nintendo threw their weight around and was like, hey, you can either pay millions of dollars in court fees, or you can pay us a few less millions of dollars and delete all your shit.
So, for context for those who don't know, there was a Switch emulator by the name of Yuzu, that if I have my understanding correct, the person who coded it had a Patreon set up so that, you know, it could support his work, and he had versions of Yuzu locked behind, like, Patreon exclusivity, which Nintendo caught wind of this and basically sued him out of existence. To be clear, we are on the side of the guy coding Yuzu. I don't know if that needs to be said, but I feel like it should be said.
Yeah, and frankly, he should be paid for his work because that is impressive work.
It's impressive, important work that Nintendo will not do. They will not work to preserve their own back catalog. And it is Nintendo abusing the law in the way that they so often do by threatening a lawsuit that would not succeed but would bankrupt them either way, so they might as well, so they are, have no choice but to play along.
Mm-hmm. And like, the Switch has been out for long enough that they're not even like protecting modern Switch sales. They're doing this all so that whenever their sequel to the Switch comes out, people are too scared to make an emulator of their own for that.
Coinciding with this has been like my experience of my PS2's laser dying and constantly being like, oh, I need to go get it, you know, like taken in someplace for repairs. But then like I had bought I bought a used PSP because my PSP was busted, and like a day after getting it, it broke too. Just the laser stopped working, the drive stopped working mm-hmm. on that as well. And it's just like driving home to me the fallibility of this old tech.
Yes, because we are dealing with 20 plus year old tech at this point. This is why one of the more popular things with Dreamcast, for example, this is something I want to get for the Dreamcast I own, is a optical drive emulator that basically it would get rid of the ability to play discs, unfortunately. But what it does is that you take out the optical drive altogether, and in its place, you're basically putting an SD card, and it loads the ISO there directly into the Dreamcast's memory. There have been some other advancements made. In fact, I think there are optical drive emulators for Dreamcast and Saturn that actually keep optical drive functionality as well. But yeah, these lasers are failing. Even the PS2, those lasers are going to fail at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the past couple of months, I think you and Jen have definitely been on this. You've been on a journey. Tell us a little bit about it.
Part of it for me is that just whatever I can't think of anything to watch, I just go on YouTube and watch these people like review various.
Okay. I thought that sentence was going to be far. Sometimes when I can't think of anything to watch, I just start stealing games. Just like, I mean, fair, but what a weird jump.
But yeah, these people who review emulation handhelds, and I got Kyrie one for Christmas, and
which I have liked quite a bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, glad you liked it. And I happened to get like one of the biggest tax breaks I've ever gotten at the same time that I finally started my new job. So I was like, what can I get without like using up this entire tax break, but also it'll just be something cool to poke at. Now, I decided to pick up an Ein Odin 2, the Pro model. And, it's basically an Android handheld that you can install a bunch of Android emulators on. And because of that, I can basically play GameCube, James Bond games, 1080 snowboarding, whatever, on this handheld that has a ridiculously large battery. Like, when you're running it at full power, like full performance mode, that's like 6 hours. And that's just the performance mode. If you're playing something lower, like a NES game or something on the Game Boy, or hell, even something on the PS1, you can get it going for like 10 hours, 12 hours, 16 hours.
It's quite a little machine. And it can emulate basically to the generation of consoles that included the GameCube and PS2. It even has the analog triggers on the GameCube, which that was the part that impressed me, was even though only a couple of GameCube games, even first-party Nintendo games, used that functionality, it is cool to have full compatibility.
Yeah. And because that was coming, I was like, damn, I gotta get some stuff to play with this. So,
now,
around that time, I started looking at, I guess we just have to come out and say that we've been...
we've been downloading video games.
Yes,
anyway.
Yeah, we've been downloading video games. So I started doing that, and then this thing happened, and then I just made it my mission for, like, a few...
Can you take that again without saying the name of a site that could get sniffed out?
Okay, yeah, good idea. So... I started getting stuff, and then the place I was getting stuff from switched to a model where you had to enter the codes they gave you in order to download things because their advertisers caught wind of what they were doing. And when that happened, I spent like several days in a row, maybe even a little bit longer, just going to each console, going down the list A to Z, picking up anything that caught my eye, or anything that seemed of historical
or anything that you might one day catch your eye. You had a broad net.
I did, yes. But, like, there's so many cool things that I didn't even know existed, and I still don't know much about that I would love to learn more, because, have you ever heard of Gladius 6?
Yes.
Okay, because I had not, and the idea of LucasArts making this fantasy Rome turn-based strategy game is so buck wild to me. That's like, damn, I just need to see what this is about.
Yeah, they used also, to make, like, video games.
That's the other thing. Like, given the way the industry has been going, I've been turning more and more to older stuff because there's so much more diversity in what you're playing. There's all sorts of different genres. There's a lot of stuff that just straight up doesn't work well, but at the same time, it's so fucking cool just to see them going for it. And yeah, like, part of my reason to be this broad is that, like, I don't know what the availability is going to be like in the future, so I want to make sure that if I ever do get interested in something, it'll be right there.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
I have not necessarily been on the same kick, but I do know that feeling of wanting to have something because you don't know where it's, you know, with this stuff, you don't know where it's going to go next, right? Mm-hmm. That's why, like, I remember at one point, I have a modded Wii that I made my own backups of Wii and GameCube games. And just so that I knew that I had a copy just ready to go because, you know, the Wii PS2, they're this 20-year-old hardware or close to it, I think.
Yeah.
Getting close to it.
Yeah. And I think, like, on my end, like, I mean, I am somewhat concerned about stuff going away. I mean, I think there are some things that will genuinely go away. I believe that, right? There are some games that you will not be able to get. But for the most part, a lot of the stuff I'm worried about, it's not that it's going to necessarily go away. It'll just become harder and harder to find. It'll be like the sources become more and more unwieldy. And I, you know, there's something about, like, I have a PS2 emulator open right now. And I can look at this and be like, hell yeah, what the fuck is Psygirls? I've always been curious. Like, someone did a fan translation of .hack Fragment? That's crazy. I would love to play the prototype of Oni 2 that accidentally got leaked. Like, this shit's a River King. Fuck yeah.
Let's go. Like,
yeah.
And even, this is also, like, if anyone is listening to this and is, like, mad, I mean, one, die mad, right? But, like... They've done this to themselves, right? Like, and not just hardware manufacturers, not just game, like, you know, makers. I, like, for a long time, I was not emulating things because I was like, no, I want to play them on authentic hardware. and like I want to, like, I'm willing to pay the money. And then it's like, oh, okay, if you want dot hack infection part one, that is like $15. Mutation, 20. Outbreak, 30. Quarantine, 200. Like, what?
Yeah.
What are you talking
because
about?
That's another.
Fuck you.
Because that's another aspect to this is that because, so you can kind of tie this in some ways to the pandemic and a lot of stuff around, like, this is the same shit of, like, the NFT people or whatever, of artificial, like, introducing artificial scarcity and the way in which things like, oh, grading the rarity of certain old Nintendo games that are, like, which are, to be clear, auctions for laundering money.
I mean, this is, it's also like, it is literally, like, I mean, it is price fixing is happening. People, like, collectors, like, there are only so many people who have a copy of Dot Hack Quarantine who are willing to part with it. And so those people are selling the game back and forth to each other to raise the average price deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have people making trips to Japan explicitly to get retro games at a low price and then charge 10 times as much once they get back home. It's to the point where a lot of retailers in Japan wised up and just started charging more for it. So you got a lot of YouTubers making videos like, oh, turns out the retro paradise that was supposed to be Japan got destroyed because suddenly they're charging more. And it's like, yeah, they're charging more because of you motherfuckers.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's genuinely upsetting what they did to that market, because it was really cool that for, like, I did, like, when I was living in Japan, I found multiple copies of Chrono Trigger for, like, next to nothing. And I bought those specifically just so I would have a copy and my brother would have a copy, because we love those, we love that game so much. And, but now it's like, yeah, like I said, these YouTubers, these retro collectors are flying over there, taking advantage of the lower prices and then selling it back in the market, or getting them locked behind plastic to, like, give an artificial grading to jack up the price to the thousands, just so that, like I saw that auction or whatever of Mario Brothers 1 in box that was, you know, sold for thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, Mario 1 and Duck Hunt is the most plentiful game in existence. Like, guys.
Yeah.
The one that really just drives me over the edge is the, like, the price gouging for Pokemon. You know,
oh,
Pokemon,
that's been going on
the
for
thing
years.
Where you open up a sock drawer in someone's house and you will find a Pokemon cartridge.
Excuse me, they're under the bed. It's not in my socks, Jen.
I said drawer, not actual socks.
No, it's not. It's not in any kind of drawer. It's an under bed. You want me? I could reach it from here. I could lean over here and click it open.
Oh boy!
All right. What do you want? Okay, here's.
I know you had a copy of Leapy Agents out recently.
Okay, here's Pokemon Blue. Here it is.
But yeah, like, you should not be paying $200 to $300 for an old Pokemon game. That's just ridiculous.
Here's the other thing. There was, at one point, and Nintendo is partially to blame for this, is on the Wii and Wii U, you could just pay a couple bucks and play an emulated version of a bunch of different games. Like, everybody loves Wii Shop Wednesday. You know, everybody loved that. Mm-hmm. And what Nintendo now does is they have ROMs in the same way, but it's locked behind their online service. And there's no way for me to, like, if you could do this on 3DS as well, where I could give Nintendo $5 and I could be playing Pokemon Silver, which is, like, a reasonable transaction to make, you know?
Well, it's not. It's not. We've tricked ourselves into thinking that's reasonable, and it certainly could be worse, right? But, like, the work that they did to make that game, they did a long time ago, and the work that they did to make a working emulator for that game, they did a long time ago.
Or stole it from people who made it. Yeah, to be clear.
Or stole it. But, like, if they wanted to, for only the cost of hosting these files, and they're tiny fucking files, they could release several hundred old games tomorrow.
To be playable on a browser. Like, internet connections are fast enough, or it's just, yeah, it's kilobytes of data. Like, it's nothing. And
the cool old games that are made by studios that need your help aren't going to get the money for it. They're not going to get the profits from this old game, from these little things, because they're going to get screwed. The people who are going to get paid for this stuff are places like Nintendo, who are going to use that money to sue people for trying to make passion projects. Just steal it all.
It is also, it is always morally correct to steal from Nintendo.
Also, like, I've been to a few talks before, held by Frank Cifaldi, who founded the Video Game History Foundation in 2016. Mm-hmm. And he's pointed out that several of the games that were on the Wii Shop, like even Mario games, had little traces in the code that proved that these ROMs only existed because fans ripped them and were, like, distributing them as ROMs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I got one of the things I grabbed in my scramble was I grabbed the two BS Zelda games.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Not bullshit, folks. That's the, like, Nintendo, like, Satellaview, like, airwave-delivered Zelda game that, like, if Nintendo remembers that they made those, they certainly don't have the fucking code for them. Mm-hmm. It's gone. It is only because crazy people stole it that we have any record of this.
Right. Yeah, there's, like, it is one of those things where, again, Frank Cifaldi put out, like, the Video Game History Foundation put out this statistic. I forget the exact number, but the number of video games commercially available is very thin compared to what has been released in the past. Because, you know, Nintendo, Sony, Sega, whoever, they're not going to put in the effort to preserve these things. And yeah.
87% of all classic video games released in the US are no longer commercially available.
That's the equivalent of, I believe, pre-sound World War II, basically it's a number of, like, there's tons of, like, lost film in the world because of just degrading film and also burned libraries and things like that it's not great. It's not great, folks.
You have a moral imperative to preserve art.
Because they're not
good. If the laws of man go against the laws of art win.
Yeah, even Frank, who, like, works with various companies to try and preserve things and all that other stuff, like, most of his talks end with, you should steal shit.
Should steal shit. And you should mod shit. That's the other thing that's cool, is once you have these games like this, right? Once you have just these files, like, tip of the iceberg is translations, right? Do you want to play a version of Armored Core where it uses dual analog sticks?
You can get that. Yeah.
Do you want to play a version of Chrono Trigger where you are playing as Goku? That exists. You can get that.
You want to get one thing that's also really cool are things like randomizers and practice ROMs, you know? One of my favorite games is a mod of Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, and that is just modding that original file, and that's really cool. Or what speedrunners do is they set up practice ROMs so that they can do the crazy tricks that you see at GDQs.
Mm-hmm. And retranslations, and some people deciding they need to uncensor things, which, like, usually, I guess, is fine, though it comes from a weird place. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at someone who patched one of the Game Boy Advance Yu-Gi-Oh! Games to be harder. You psychopath. Like, there's just shit out there.
I saw a patch that was, speaking of Yu-Gi-Oh! Game Boy games, that they finally made a certain set of cards work correctly. Where there were three cards that you could play called, like, United Revolution or whatever, that is supposed to automatically win you the game if you play it in conjunction with two other cards. And that was just broken. And someone went in there and fixed the code.
Oh, yeah, I see it right here.
Yep.
And, like, we did mention briefly just translations earlier, but, like, that scene has exploded over the past few years to the point where just all sorts of things that you never even heard about but have this amazing concept behind it have been unearthed. Like, this is going to be something, by the way, that I'm going to push for Novel Not New at some point, but there's this RPG called Rowdy Princess where there's no leveling, there's no experience, nothing like that. How you perform in combat is all down to how you resolve matters within various dialogue sequences and VN segments. And that's so fucking cool.
That's nice, but what if we played the recently translated fighting game for the Sega Saturn, Rabbit?
What is Rabbit?
A fighting game for the Sega Saturn. Need I say more? Yes, but I don't know more. Here's the cover art of Rabbit.
Huh.
All right.
There's a world out there. There's a world out there. A world that you would never see any other way.
Yeah.
Play a copy of I Love Softball. Yeah, it's just, it has been, like, honestly, I feel that as a member of Scanline Media, I have an obligation to have thoughts and opinions on currently releasing games, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is, like, in theory, it draws, you know, listeners and viewers, readers, whatever. And, like, it keeps us relevant. It keeps our tastes, like, helps us understand, like, what is the going concerns in the industry. If I wasn't worried about any of that, I would just stop buying games for a while and just play through all this cool shit that I could never reach before.
Absolutely.
I partially agree with that, but also, like, in addition to having a few big games every once in a while just completely catch my eye. There's so much cool shit being released by indies these days. Like, there's been the whole retro revival thing, and mostly that's been on predictable lines. Like, oh, here's a bunch of retro first-person shooters and stuff. But, like, earlier this year, someone made a retro tribute to the fucking CDI Zelda games and made a good game out of it.
Oh, Arzette. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to check that out too.
Yeah, that's just buck wild to me. Like, people are just coming up with all sorts of cool ideas. It's just like they aren't getting funded and AAA is going it a certain way. So, yeah.
AAA is like super cooked.
Yeah. It is so cooked.
Six, for context, Arzette, like how much of a CDI tribute it is. They found the people who voiced Zelda and Link from the Zelda CDI games and asked them to voice a role. And they did it.
The thing is, those games looked and played like shit. Is that worth doing a tribute to? I mean, like, I appreciate the artistic thing. I just don't know if I want to play that.
Well, the thing is, they made the game part play good, and the cutscenes just, like, the cutscenes have a good sense of humor to them, even though they are emulating the nightmare fuel artistic choices that the CDI games
YouTube have. YouTube poop fuel, Jen. Get it right. Bob's rope? Or lamp oil?
Come back when you're a little richer.
Well. Yeah, I don't mean to disrespect the efforts of, I mean, like, that is part of the problem, right? It's how focused we can get, like, how focused we can get on AAA or quadruple A or even double A releases, right? Like,
yep.
It's the best art is always going to come from people making choices, not people looking at the results of a poll.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of all there is to it.
Yeah. It.
We're doing a, you know, this is going to come out. This can be the moment where I reveal it, folks. This is coming out March 21st. Starting the first week of April, we're going to have some Final Fantasy VII Rebirth coverage, some extensive coverage, and that game fucking sucks.
It's so bad.
It has its moments, but yeah, like, the story just constantly makes me go, what are you doing here? And
we're going to have hours of podcast about it.
We're going to have a lot. And I was really excited because I had a great time with Remake. And playing this game, not only am I having a bad time, I'm like, I was wrong. I was having a bad time with Remake and didn't know it. Maybe I don't like Final Fantasy VII. Maybe I don't like Final Fantasy. Obviously, a lot of this overreaction. Some of this not.
Later, I'm also going to be reviewing Alone in the Dark, which... speaking of people making choices, like, the reviews for that have come out, and it's been everywhere from 9s to 2s, which is the most interesting area to me. Like, what the fuck is happening that people have such wildly divergent opinions on this? So, yeah, look forward to that.
As always, we are working on stuff.
Jen wants to play Alone in the Dark. Kyrie is regretting being alone with a dork.
Oh. Oh. It's just Knives Out, this episode for 6.
I love this is the thing about knowing me. It's like, I will say really hostile shit that I, like, -5% believe, but I thought it was a fun play on words. I was like, this is a terrible thing to say to my best friend, and I don't believe it, and also it's hurtful, but what a good play on words. Yeah, this seems like the end of an episode, doesn't
yep.
it?
Yep.
Sure does.
Well, we'll be back hopefully sooner than 4 months this time to talk about some more stuff. But until then, folks, we're doing a lot of other work. You can find it, first of all, on our personal accounts, starting with Kyrie. Where would people find you personally and your things?
You'll find me on Twitter, Kyrie A Page, and on co-host, Kyrie A Page, no A in the middle there. That's where you'll find me. That's where I'll post stuff, mostly retweeting and reposting stuff. But, you know, I am present.
Okay. All right. Jen, what about you?
You can find me at JBU3 on Twitter. You can find me on Coast. Not coast.
Coasting.
Find me on the coast.
Find me on the coast surfing.
You can find my co-host at Jennifer and Aster. And you can find me on Blue Sky under the name Spooky Cute Witch.
You can find me on Twitter and co-host at SixDetmar, SIXDETTMAR. My DMs are open there for any questions, comments, or listener feedback for this or any other Scanline works. And folks, if you want to see some of that Scanline work that we're talking about, scanlinemedia.com, patreon.com/scanlinemedia. We do a bunch of podcasts. We do some streams. We do some articles. We do all sorts of work, and we would appreciate you checking it out. But until then, folks, peace out.
See ya.
Later.